This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are turning our attention to a USA Today investigation about police accountability and what happens to police officers who risk their jobs and sometimes their lives to blow the whistle on wrongdoing in their departments. The investigation, Behind the Blue Wall of Silence, documents how law enforcement agencies respond when one of their own exposes police corruption, brutality, or other misconduct. USA Today reporters found systemic, unchecked retaliation at departments large and small across the country. The series reveals how police departments have adopted an unofficial system of retaliation that allows misconduct to persist and helps police leaders avoid accountability, while communities of color and other marginalized groups bear the brunt of police brutality. The profession is blind to race, gender, and seniority when it comes to punishing officers who try to expose these practices. USA Today set out to establish for the first time the extent of law enforcement's blue wall of silence and its impact on the individual officers who've defied it, as well as the communities they police. Joining us to discuss this investigation is Gina Barton, an award-winning investigative reporter with USA Today, who's been covering criminal justice issues for two decades. Gina Barton's reporting on lax oversight of police officers and deaths in police custody helped prompt a first-of-its-kind state law that requires independent investigations of all officer-involved deaths. Gina is the reporter, producer, and host of the National Edward R. Murrow Award-winning podcast Unsolved and the author of the true crime book Fatal Identity. Hi, Gina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, huge thanks to you and your colleagues for these investigations. They're very hard to read, very disturbing, but so important. Before we dive in and talk about the details, I mean, just to let listeners know, some of what we talk about might be disturbing. Why did you all decide to launch this major investigation?
Well, like almost everyone else around the country, we saw that video of George Floyd and the Minneapolis police officer kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes as three other officers just stood there, didn't help, didn't do anything. And that got us thinking about why police wouldn't intervene when they see something that egregious happening. And the answer that we came up with was the blue wall of silence. If they intervene, if they complain, if they report fellow officers for wrongdoing, they suffer terrible personal and professional consequences.
To do this piece, you all spent a year fighting for public records. You interviewed police officers and victims of misconduct. Can you talk about what happened when you directly contacted the police involved who were accused of wrongdoing?
So many of the calls that we made to police accused of wrongdoing were interesting in that they felt free to talk to us and to stand up for themselves and to say that, you know, they had done nothing wrong. And in a lot of cases, the department leaders said, these people that we spoke to were not whistleblowers. They were just disgruntled employees. They were making things up, or they were taking things out of proportion. Nothing to see here.
I want to read the lead of one of your pieces, which I think says so much. To many in law enforcement, snitching against another cop is a betrayal that can't go unpunished. Those who enforce this code, the blue wall of silence, have stuffed dead rats and feces into fellow officers' lockers. They've issued death threats, ignored requests for backup, threatened family members, and planted drugs on the officers who reported wrongdoings. Meanwhile, USA Today found that many of the cops that whistleblowers accused of misconduct kept their jobs or faced only minor punishments, and officers who lied or stayed silent in support of an accused colleague later secured promotions over time and admirations from their peers. That just says so much. Can you talk about the documents that you poured over and the work that went into this piece? I mean, you all traveled to Georgia, Illinois, Texas, Oregon, Louisiana, New York, and Florida to interview officers and victims of police misconduct.
It was just such an upside down situation that we found, right? The police officers who are trying to do the right thing, who are trying to hold their agencies accountable for misconduct and for abuse of prisoners and civilians, are the ones who are losing their jobs and being disciplined. And they were being disciplined for minor things, you know, like going outside the chain of command. Or we talked to one guy who was fired for mislabeling evidence bags. On one of those bags, he wrote an extra zero by mistake, and he was fired. And what we came to believe is that they weren't actually being fired for these procedural violations. They were being fired for the fact that they had crossed this line and spoken up against fellow officers. So we got tons of documents that described both the original misconduct allegations and then also the retaliation that the whistleblowers were complaining about and were claiming that they had suffered. And then in addition to that, and as a follow-up, we sometimes got more documents about the original incident and then went to speak with these officers and victims in person when we were able to.
You have so many examples of cops who blew the whistle. In South Carolina, an officer leaked the fact that fellow deputies beat a prisoner who later died in custody. In Florida, a detective who specialized in child sex crimes reported a captain who impregnated a 16-year-old girl and then paid for her to have an abortion. In Oregon, a sergeant complained that a coworker bragged about killing an unarmed teenager. Gina, these are just devastating examples. What stood out for you when you learned about case after case after case?
Two things were really troubling to us. One is that these sorts of things didn't just happen in the big city departments that somehow already have reputations for, you know, having bad apples on their police forces. They happened everywhere. Small departments, large departments, urban, rural, all over the country. So that was one thing that was really interesting that we found. The other aspect that really interested us was how the tables are turned and how no one seems to really care about the original misconduct. I mean, you're talking about, you know, one of the examples that you just gave, a detective reports a captain for getting a 16-year-old girl pregnant and paying for her abortion. And the person that the higher ups decide needs to be punished is the detective who reported it, not the captain who was accused of doing it. It was just nonsensical in a lot of cases.
When you're talking about what's happening at these small departments across the country, I mean, this is where media really plays such an important role. In some cases, the media might report on this issue and give it attention, and then it just takes off and might get national attention. In other cases, it gets no attention. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thing that we found is when cases of police brutality or police misconduct are covered, generally the reporting stops with the wrongdoing itself. Not a lot of different news outlets had reported on the whistleblowers and the retaliation that they suffered afterwards. So I think that while there's often reporting about a beating, a death in custody, an officer accused of wrongdoing, that second piece in terms of how was that behavior uncovered and what happened to the person who reported it, I think somehow gets lost. The other point I want to make is that we made it a point to go to places without a lot of strong investigative reporting. For example, one of our reporters, Brett Murphy, spent a month in some small towns and small departments in Louisiana where the media just hasn't been there to be a watchdog, to keep an eye on these sorts of situations. And so that's why we felt it was important for us to go and report on these incidents in places where maybe the local paper doesn't exist anymore or isn't as large or robust as it used to be.
This is so important. You're reminding me of a conversation we had last week about what we lose when we lose our local papers. And I mean, obviously, this is just one of many things that we lose. What other patterns emerged as you all connected the dots and the cases that are happening across the country?
I think an important thing that we found is that it's not just a few bad apples, right? You always hear like, oh, 99% of police officers want to do the right thing. And when things go wrong, you know, it's just an individual or a couple of individuals doing the wrong thing. But really, we found an entire system that was set up to stop whistleblowers from coming forward. So, for example, in some places, an officer who wants to report wrongdoing has to go up the chain of command. And if they want to complain about one of their supervisors, they actually have to complain to that supervisor. So you're complaining to your boss about some misconduct that your boss actually committed. So what do you think is going to be the result of that complaint? Another thing is that police leaders weaponize internal affairs. So they go after minor rule infractions in order to try to discredit whistleblowers, make them look like they're the bad cops, make them look like they are liars. And then another thing that we found was that police unions play a critical role in enforcing the blue wall of silence. One way that they do that is just by the things that they negotiate into their contracts. But another way is really showing up in force to support officers accused of wrongdoing and not doing that for officers who reported the wrongdoing.
You all analyzed more than 80 state laws and municipal union contracts and found that 30 contained at least one provision that could be used to shield officers accused of misconduct or make it more difficult for another officer to expose it. Just one example, the Chicago Police Union contract allows officers under investigation to view video footage and then change their statements.
Right. And how are you going to get an honest statement that holds someone accountable that way, right? People say that video, squad video and body camera video is one of the best tools to hold police accountable for misconduct. But if you let somebody watch that video before they tell you what happened, then they can make sure that whatever story they come up with matches the video. Another thing that some departments do is there's a waiting period between the incident and when the police can question them. So if the internal affairs can't question the officer accused of wrongdoing or any of the witnesses, that gives them time to get their story straight. It also theoretically could give somebody who is a bad actor an opportunity to try to intimidate his fellow officers into not coming forward.
Today, we're speaking with Gina Barton, an award-winning investigative reporter with USA Today, who's been covering criminal justice issues for two decades. Gina and her colleagues are out with an incredible USA Today investigation about police accountability and what happens to police officers who risk their jobs and sometimes their lives to blow the whistle on wrongdoing in their department. There's a whole package of articles, including a 21-minute documentary, Behind the Blue Wall of Silence, How Law Enforcement Punishes Its Whistleblowers. And let's just play a quick clip from this documentary. This is Scott McKee, a former lieutenant in the Springfield, Oregon Police Department.
We have the impression that when we point the finger internally and we blow the whistle internally on something that is not right, we expect to be rewarded for that. I mean, that's integrity, you know? And I think what shocks people in policing who whistleblow is that that's not the case, that you're regarded as a traitor, that you have committed an act of treason against the organization and they treat you like a traitor.
That's Scott McKee, former lieutenant in the Springfield, Oregon Police Department. A short clip from the documentary that's part of this USA Today investigation, Behind the Blue Wall of Silence. You spoke with so many officers about this, Gina. What else stood out for you? One quote that stood out for us, DeLacy Davis, founder of Black Cops Against Police Brutality, said, "Your findings prove that the system is part of an intentional effort that ultimately promotes the oppression of the nation's most marginalized groups, and that this is not, like you said, just an issue of a few bad apples."
Exactly. I mean, one of the starkest examples that we found does involve Scott McKee, that lieutenant that you just played. He actually helped free a wrongfully convicted man from prison 7 years into a 20-year sentence. And he was able to uncover that a former detective in his department had buried a report with some evidence that potentially could have exonerated this man, Gary Tiffey. And so due to Lieutenant McKee's work, Gary Tiffey got out of prison 13 years early. Wow. And Lieutenant McKee was just driven out of the department. That detective that played a role in the wrongful conviction remained on the job until he was later fired for drunken driving. Mm. So even when people's lives and livelihoods are at stake, blowing the whistle is going to cause problems for a police officer's career.
Another whistleblower, Shannon Spaulding, a former undercover narcotics officer in Chicago, faced death threats and resigned after she exposed a corruption scheme that led to dozens of overturned convictions. Again, overturned convictions. This is people's lives we're talking about. Shannon Spaulding said, "I'm an officer without a department. I lost my house. I lost my marriage. It affects you in ways you would never imagine."
Right. And I think that that was something that we heard over and over and over, because when you work in law enforcement, it's not just a regular job. You know, you're not just showing up and sitting at your desk and kind of doing your own job all day. You're protecting each other and you're supporting each other and you're putting your life in these people's hands. So they become your best friends. They become like a surrogate family for you. And when you speak out against one of those fellow officers, you're not only losing your career, but you're losing your friends and your social life. I spoke to one officer who was supposed to stand up in a fellow officer's wedding, and then he reported somebody for misconduct. Not only was he uninvited from standing up in the wedding, he was uninvited from even coming to the wedding. So their whole lives revolve around their careers. And so to have that destroyed in this way is just devastating.
Have you heard from any lawmakers about this investigation? Have any lawmakers commented on this?
We've had lawmakers and lobbyists talk to us. When we first started this reporting, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act was still pending. It has since stalled. Mm-hmm. But there are definitely legislators and lobbyists who want to bring back some of the elements that were in various versions of that bill. And lots of people who really think specific whistleblower protections for police officers need to be instituted, since some of the other protections that would apply to you and me don't apply to them because of their jobs.
Hmm. Because reading the piece, I was thinking about the uprisings around the murder of George Floyd. So many people, as we all know, millions of people took to the streets from all walks of life, and legislation was introduced at all levels. And then you read a piece like this and you just wonder, you know, what is happening with all of that momentum? And that's the first question. And then the second question, Gina, what sort of reaction have you received from this piece, from your colleagues in the media, given that these issues got so much attention when George Floyd was murdered?
It was so disheartening to so many legislators and citizens alike when the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act failed to pass Congress. That was really troubling to lots of people, because when you have momentum like that, I think that just shows that the American people want some sort of change. And for that not to be legislated at the federal level was really disheartening to a lot of people. There was a pretty significant bill in Illinois that mandated use of body cameras and decertification for people who retaliate against their police coworkers, broadened the definition of retaliation. So I think some things are still continuing to happen on the state level in states where there have been documented issues with police brutality and whistleblower retaliation. In terms of the media, our colleagues around the USA Today network and around the country, I think are really encouraged by the fact that we were able to get so many documents, and also the fact that so many police officers were willing to share their stories with us, and we're grateful for our work, because often the relationship between police and journalists is an antagonistic one, especially when you're talking about police misconduct. That blue wall, those same people who enforce the blue wall among their colleagues, also don't want journalists to know about police misconduct or bring that to light. So it was really encouraging that we were able to meet and talk with some officers who really appreciated the work that we do and our efforts to combat police brutality and the secrecy that surrounds it.
Gina, we're going to do a two-part series to continue to focus on your piece because it's so important. And I just want to ask you in our remaining minutes, what stood out for you about the victims of police brutality? The 20-minute documentary that you all put together was so hard to watch. I mean, it's just brutal. Almost every single person in this video, whether it's the victim or a victim's family, is someone of color. So what really stood out for you?
Well, and I think that that's an excellent point that, you know, people of color do tend to be victimized by police officers more often, if only because they're arrested and taken into custody more often. So I think the fact that the whistleblowers that we found were all races and genders and all kind of suffered that same retaliation and the same problems for bringing it forward says a lot about the scope of the problem.
What really stood out for you when you spoke with family members who are still trying to get justice for their loved ones?
I think a huge thing that stood out to us is that a lot of these family members did not know what happened until we found that video or that document or that piece of evidence that showed something terrible had happened and there was a whistleblower. So the families have been left in the dark because officers close ranks and go after the whistleblowers. So they're left in the dark. They're left looking for answers. And it takes not only someone within the department to step up and call out that behavior and present that evidence, but I think it also requires cooperation from the media to get that evidence out there in the public eye.
Exactly. And it just raises the point that there are so many names we've never heard of, but they also deserve media attention. Is there any story in our remaining minute that stands out for you, or an experience once a family member read your story and learned more about what happened to their loved one?
Well, the story of Javier Esqueda, the whistleblower in Joliet, Illinois, who uncovered a custody death, was a heartbreaking one. And if you watch that documentary that you mentioned, that's the one that we have video of the death, which was called an overdose death, but really the police didn't get this man help and should have. And so my colleague Daphne Durrett spent a lot of time with his widow, who just couldn't believe all the cover-up that had happened surrounding her husband's death.
I mean, that video was so hard to watch.
Oh, for us too. It was terrible.
What's next for this series? I mean, again, huge thanks to all of you who put so much time into this piece. What's next? Or these pieces, well, I should say.
So right now, we are putting the finishing touches on our database of 300 whistleblower cases that we found throughout the country. So hopefully in the next few weeks, that will be available on our website so that people will be able to go and search for departments in their towns or their states and see what's been happening with police brutality and cover-ups surrounding that. And then we're continuing to report based on tips that we got from this series. After our pieces ran, we got more than 100 emails and phone calls from police officers who said they too had blown the whistle on misconduct and had been silenced.
Wow. Well, we are definitely going to do more shows about this because there are so many more stories and angles to take. Gina Barton is an award-winning investigative reporter with USA Today who's been covering criminal justice issues for two decades. Gina and her colleagues wrote incredible investigations, Behind the Blue Wall of Silence. It documents how law enforcement agencies respond when one of their own exposes police corruption, brutality, or other misconduct. Reporters found systemic, unchecked retaliation at departments large and small across the country. Gina, thank you so much for joining us. And again, huge thanks to your colleagues also.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciated being here.
Thank you. You can find the series and the 20-minute documentary at yourcallradio.org. We will definitely do follow-ups in the coming weeks. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.